As Malcolm joins us, and of course, those of you who are tuned in for the very first time, please realize that we're now back on a regular schedule, which means that every Friday at 7:40, we explore the events of the week, or in this case, a couple of weeks, during what we call the weekly update. Malcolm Honlein will join us in just a moment, and as he joins us, I will just read this notice that I've been saving, and so many people have been saving for weeks. And then we'll get Malcolm's comments toward the beginning of our conversation. On April the 8th, which is 3 days from now, on April the 8th, Jonathan Pollard will have spent 10,000 days in prison. We are 3 days away from his 10,000th day. What you could do to help obtain his release in a notice that was put in the newspaper a few weeks back. Of course, number one, pray for Yehonatan Alevi ben Malka. The Jerusalem Post editorial, which you could search for, it's called CIA Game Changer, is one that should be read and distributed. It's from back in December, and you should send a copy of the editorial to your congressman, your senator, demand urgent action to end this travesty of justice. And of course, President Obama should be called to request the release of Pollard at area code 202-456-1414, 202-456-1414. Malcolm Honlein is the Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and joins us for a weekly update on this Friday morning. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Good morning to you, and welcome back to the air.
I appreciate that. No more important way to start, even with all the urgent news items out there, than with what I just read. Any comments as we now approach, Jonathan Pollard approaches his 10,000th day?
Well, everybody, I think, should be outraged by the fact that 10,000 days in prison and years spent in isolation is a punishment that far exceeds any crime, any justification, and that anybody who hasn't written or spoken to public officials or who hasn't made their voice heard on this, this is really a case that goes beyond any of the arguments that were put forward in the past. He has expressed remorse. His physical condition demands his release. The length of time that he has served, all of these plus some of the earlier transgressions of the plea bargaining agreement, all of things in the past, and I think it's reflected in the fact that many of the people who opposed his release, talking about American officials like Jim Woolsey, the head of the CIA, former head of the CIA, Kissinger, George Shultz, both secretaries of state, Lawrence Korb, who was worked under Weinberger at the Defense Department, the people who were involved in the case have come out in support of his release. And it's only by keeping the issue in the forefront, and I raised it with the president when we met with him, we've raised it consistently. It was raised by leaders of Israel on the president's recent trip, as it was by prime ministers over many years. And though some people deny it, I have actually witnessed to it. I've seen prime ministers raise it with the president and heard firsthand the accounts. There is still a strong opposition within government circles, and it will only be overcome by continued efforts, our tefillot and our advocacy.
Malcolm, you've said what you just said probably close to 1,000 times, and I appreciate it. I'm sure everybody out there appreciates the fact that you continue to say it with such intensity and freshness, because if we lose that enthusiasm for trying to get him released, that would be very bad. So that you're setting a very good example. Not that you need my compliments on this, but you're setting a good example for all of us that the pressure has to be kept up, and it has to be kept up at the same level that we've been used to over all these months.
And there are two levels. People want to write me all the time about it, and I tell them it's not good to write me. Write the president. Write the people who can make a decision. Believe me, we argue this all the time, and I've been to see Jonathan in jail, and I tell you, after that, you cannot but come away committed after meeting him and seeing how he has lasted this torturous existence is frankly beyond me. And yet he remains calm, and he's very intelligent, he's very forthcoming. When you meet with him, and I think he has no interest in becoming a, you know, a symbol. He wants to lead a quiet life, build his own life, his family, with his wife, and I think it's something he's entitled to. This is a humanitarian matter, a matter of justice to me.
And we have heard off the record, I would say, from prison officials on more than one occasion, from different people who have visited there, that most people never expected him to live this long. That's how difficult the circumstances are in prisons like the one he's in.
Absolutely, and the medical care is not what he needs right now. He's been hospitalized several times. So I hope people will continue to take it seriously and make their voices heard.
2 weeks ago today was the last time we spoke on the air regarding current events. I think within the hour of when our conversation ended, a very significant event occurred, and that was due to extreme pressure by the President of the United States. The Prime Minister of Israel, by telephone, apologized to Erdogan of Turkey for the flotilla response, the response to that episode that you'll recall from 2010. I'm so curious as to your reaction to that whole Friday afternoon in Israel when that apology took place.
Well, the evidence points in a different direction, that it was the Prime Minister who asked the President to make the call after Erdogan made the apology for his comments, his horrific comments about Zionism. He did back off of it and made a public apology that the Prime Minister then asked the President to intervene and to make the call. Because it's in Israel's interest, especially given what they are facing in Syria and the common, you know, sometimes it's common enemy that can bring you together. The you know, the trade between the two countries is very important for both, and it has continued, in fact, increased even during this time. This is not a reconciliation, and I think people should not exaggerate what has actually taken place. That the call was important. Israel was being blocked from NATO by Iran and other things that were going on, that where the two countries should be cooperating. It's not going to go back to what it was. I don't think that Erdogan is ready to really accept Israel fully. He's setting conditions. He's talking about visiting Gaza. He's demanding a lifting of the blockade. He wants the compensation to be paid in advance, and they're asking for $1 million. Israel's offering $100,000. The general average, I think, in these cases is $300,000. So I guess that they'll negotiate out. There's a committee working on those details. But, you know, when it comes, for instance, to military cooperation between the two countries, those who were responsible, those who had implemented the past cooperation, the remarkable cooperation between Turkey and Israel on security and military matters, are no longer there. He's arrested all these generals. He's removed them all from office. Right. So you have a whole new crew. It doesn't mean there can't be some measures, but one shouldn't expect a revolutionary change, a rush to return to past relationship. The poison that he spread is still in the veins of many of the people and in the system. And as long as he believes that he has more to gain from being seen as hostile, if you remember, this was motivated in large part by his desire to become the leader in the Middle East, and his popularity soared after he walked out on President Perez in Davos 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden, when he started his diplomatic initiatives, whether in Egypt, in Libya, and other places, he failed.
So you're telling...
And they rejected him.
You're telling us that without the Prime Minister's initiation, this whole thing would never have happened.
I do not believe it would have happened.
And also, tell me about the timing. If this is so important, Netanyahu felt that for Israel this was so urgent, why not a year ago, 2 years ago? Why not a month after the episode?
Well, Israel has tried all along. We had negotiating teams visiting Turkey. We've seen other efforts, statements by the Prime Minister that you know, he would like to reconcile, and that it was Erdogan who was blocking all these initiatives. Turkey's an important player in the regional situation as it worsens, especially vis-a-vis Iran. This relationship has potential importance, has real importance. So it's not that there weren't efforts in the past. If you remember, General Amidur went there earlier, Chikanover and others, they had delegations working on trying to resolve differences over the Mavi Marmara and other things, and they rejected it. The apology gave the Prime Minister the opening to make this initiative.
Do you agree with those who say the apology made the Prime Minister look weak, made Israel look weak in the international picture?
I don't think it made Israel necessarily look weak. The Prime Minister's apology was very defined, and it's nothing different than what he said before. And he said he didn't apologize for blocking the Mavi Marmara. He apologized for any missteps or miscalculations that they made. So I don't remember the exact wording, but if you read it carefully, you will see that it wasn't an apology for exercising their right to defend themselves.
The Mavi Marmara claimant, the one who was awarded the money, how much money was he awarded, and did it all go to Hamas?
Well, nobody was awarded. They're saying any money that they get, nobody's even gotten anything yet.
So it was just a public proclamation that if we win any funds, it's going
to... If we get anything, I'm going to give it to Hamas, et cetera.
And what does that tell us, by the way? When the people who, you know, the peacemakers and those who are trying to, you know, do humanitarian efforts aboard that ship, all of a sudden are dedicating their funds to Hamas.
Let's wait and see first if they actually do it.
I understand, but just
when they get that check, it ain't.
I understand, but just a public statement, isn't that enough?
Yeah, because it's grandstanding, and I don't dismiss it.
We're having a lot of trouble hearing you. I'm sorry.
I said I think that this is a sign of the poison that's been injected into the system.
Yeah, I understand, but you cannot use the aftermath of that episode of telling everybody you're on a humanitarian mission and dedicate your funds to a terrorist organization.
Why not? So the group that sponsored it was a terrorist organization. The IHH has been involved and accused of all sorts of involvements in these kind of activities, and the people who were involved were not there on a humanitarian mission. We know that the materials.
But that was their claim. I know.
It's all a sham.
But stick to your story. That's their claim. You don't think if you stick to it, if you're going to claim you're on a humanitarian mission,
you want them to stick to a story.
On paper, it doesn't look right. What can I tell you? We move on because we see, and boy, oh boy, a lot of people over Pesach were talking about this. Are we heading back to the future? We're heading back to a few months ago in terms of what happened in the southern part of Israel. Rockets are raining down on Sderot. You could tell us at what pace. Is there a possibility, God forbid, that we're looking at a full-scale attack again where Israel is going to have to intervene?
Look, I think the Prime Minister is going to be under tremendous pressure internally, and people will accuse him of having failed to complete the job when we had Operation Pillar of Cloud or Pillar of Defense, that, when we had tens of thousands of troops, Israeli troops on the border, people will say he should have moved then. It's not something tolerable, and you know that one of the rockets that was fired was found yesterday to have gone through the roof of a preschool near Sderot. Thank God it was Yontif and the people were not there.
Right.
But there were four or five rockets fired since the end of the war. They were fired now by Hamas because they've acknowledged their involvement directly in it, and we see that a more aggressive stance. Supposedly, also even Fajar 5s are being shipped back. This may be into the Sinai rather than into Gaza. But even the Egyptians now you see reacting to the developments in Gaza because they found out that those tunnels are a two-way street. They in fact revealed that Hamas has a special committee that designates who can open a tunnel and then oversees the management and, of course, takes a cut. But the Egyptians are saying it's costing them $1 billion a year, and all of a sudden the weapons are coming into Egypt along with Hamas guys and people who threaten the security of Egypt and the Sinai. So this escalation is targeting various developments. One was when President Obama came, saw rockets, and they said it was, you know, in advance of his visit or at the time to mark his visit. And then this was supposedly in solidarity with the hunger striking of the prisoners against the Israeli prison system because of the prisoner who died of cancer,
right,
and was known to have had cancer. And this was no secret, and the Palestinians knew. And now they're accusing Israel again of neglect and of being responsible for his death. It's all an excuse by the PA to rally people and to escalate the violence in a contained way, but they're going to find out at some point that it's it's going to escalate out of control. So the rockets that were fired, people will say, you know, there are only two, three, four. This is very significant, and it's a challenge to Israel, one that Israel cannot allow to go unanswered as they hit the two of the major sites where terrorist attacks and these rockets were being launched. And the new defense minister, Yaakov Yalom, made very clear that they are going to respond in very tough ways to whatever attempts there are to attack Israel, whether it's building tunnels underground or whether it's the launching of missiles. Any of these things have to be responded to in strong ways.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Reminder, Yom HaShoah is being observed Monday instead of Sunday, all because of the sanctity of Shabbos, which we should talk about, but we won't spend the time right now. The point is that Monday will be our Yom HaShoah commemoration, although it'll be the 28th of Nisan. And a day 10 in the counting of the Omer, if you forgot to count last night, make sure to do so sometime today. So there has to be a response to any degree. There has to be a response to some degree of anything that happens in the South, and we're hoping that the new Israeli government will feel that they have the right to go ahead and do so, because otherwise
they have the responsibility,
right? Because otherwise things the right also, it seems sometimes, but otherwise, God forbid, things could escalate to the point to what we saw. So he dies in prison of cancer. The demonstrations take place where the Arabs end up being killed by the Israeli army, and then the more riots take place at the funeral. Where were these demonstrations?
Well, first of all, there were demonstrations were across the West Bank in many areas, and the there were several clashes places where. There were fatalities, just a limited number. But remember that we've seen this escalation, and we talked about it even 2 weeks ago and longer, that there's been this steady escalation where the PA has allowed the pot to boil, thinking that this will be a diversion from all the criticism of them. You know, polls came out and showed that 78% of the Palestinians think the government is corrupt, and 40% support a return to armed intifada. And they want the U.S. in, they want the U.S. out. This has been a build-up, and now first you had the prisoners' hunger strike,
right,
which strikes a strong chord amongst Palestinians, because many of them have relatives, many of them have people they know there, and it becomes a rallying point. And one, as I said, instigated as well by the powers to be, in order to mobilize the people, and to show that they are standing with the prisoners. As you know, they pay a salary to all of these terrorists, using the aid that they receive from abroad to pay these terrorists on a monthly basis, and some of them considerable amounts. So number one, you had reaction in Gaza, and strong reaction with the demonstrations, but even more in Yehuda and Shomron, you had many incidents. You've had fire bombs, we've had the rock throwing, which has caused fatalities. As you know, we have a young child who's still fighting for her life because of a rock-throwing incident. People, dismiss it and say, oh, it's only rocks. It's not just rocks. These are lethal weapons. Mm-hmm. People get hurt and killed because of it. And the PA is going to meet now with Kerry. Secretary Kerry is going to the Middle East again, and he will make attempts to stop this escalation. He tried, and the president tried, in their discussions with Abu Mazen, who only promised that he would stop temporarily the unilateral measures at the United Nations. The secretary is going to look for some formula. I think it's going to be very difficult and distant right now, but both sides have said they would welcome his coming to see if there's any grounds to begin to look for a formula for negotiations at some point. I don't think anybody should anticipate serious negotiations anytime soon. So and then you have to put this in the context of the regional escalations and what's happening in Jordan, what's happening in the north of Israel, for Israel's need to be preemptive and not to allow any border to go out of control.
All right, let me do some other Israel first, and then we'll get to, well, I guess we'll refer to more international. Is the brand new finance minister, Yair Lapid, in trouble by indicating that, according to him, 20,000 shekel a month means they're in the middle class in Israel?
Well, he certainly got into trouble because of it, and part of it is the inexperience, not only of him, but of many of the people who are coming into government. So I wouldn't anticipate that this will be the last incident of this kind. and you know, it's a government like the last one. Remember when Lieberman, people got elected, most of them had just been on, had names on a list and were given even ministries at times and had no clue what to do. And the Ministry of Finance is a critically important one, and I think maybe the Prime Minister, you know, plotted this by giving him this key position, thinking that it would expose him. He saw it as a great opportunity, I'm sure, to implement some of the reforms that they mm-hmm. spoke about, but,
right.
you know, he never ran anything. He's not an official. He wasn't elected to anything before, so I think this is a long learning curve.
Yeah, that's for sure. All right, a lot of listeners want to know, as I want to know, about North Korea. If you've been following the news over the Pesach holiday, everybody, this was one of the big stories, North Korea flexing its muscles. What would you say, Malcolm? Are they standing up to the United States and basically showing or trying to show the U.S. that they couldn't care less how the U.S. behaves? They're going to take the offensive in that region no matter what?
I think they have done that all along, announcing that they had the nuclear capacity, bypassing, despite the sanctions that were in place, and now more bravado on the part of the new leader, who perhaps is just trying to establish himself and to create the image, may not intend to really go all the way with what he's threatening to do, but these things tend to escalate and often can get out of control.
Right.
And he may have painted himself into a corner. And the problem is that there's very limited leverage with him. And if you're Japan, you worry about this. If you're South Korea, you worry. But we should all worry, because there was an interesting chart from Yunton, the Wall Street Journal, of comparing why North Korea is a greater threat than Iran, saying that they're more advanced in certain areas. It's a mistake, because it's a synergistic relationship. This is Iran. And Iran is North Korea. They're working together. The technology, the missile technology, is North Korean. A lot of the other technology that they are in their nuclear program is North Korean. And Iran, I think, helps finance the North Korean thing. When you had the missile launches in North Korea, Iranians were there. When you had Iranian launches, North Koreans were there. And you remember in Syria, that was a joint Iranian-North Korean project to build that nuclear reactor that Israel thankfully removed. So people should understand, again, when we talk about how everything is interrelated and how the globalization of terror and what Bush said about the axis of evil should not be dismissed. We see this now with the developments both in Iran and in North Korea.
So a 30-year-old madman could have his finger on the button of a nuclear arsenal.
Absolutely, and you know, he hasn't got much to lose. The economy there is not significant. Again, I don't think that they really want to have a war, but you get caught in the rhetoric. He's, again, inexperienced, but you have to see what they've done all along, how they've moved along becoming a nuclear power.
By the way,
irresponsible, dangerous regime.
And I mentioned, I alluded to the type of headlines that this made, you know, Sunday, Monday of this week, everywhere here in the U.S. So what is it like in Japan? I mean, are they, in fact, you know, in a complete panic situation when it comes to North Korea?
A number of years ago, I was invited to come meet the Prime Minister of Japan, the one who thought he was Elvis Presley, and in the course of the discussion, raising the issue of Iran with him, and it's a more complicated scenario than I can describe right now. But anyway, I then said, and of course, the danger of the North Korean-Iran axis. He went ballistic. So what do you mean? What do you mean? What are you talking? And I started talking about how the missiles that week had been shipped from North Korea to Iran, and Iran was upgrading some of the technology, because North Korea, the Japanese are apoplectic about North Korea. And that resonated with him and got really his attention, and got then into a very serious discussion of the issue of the threat of Iran. And So for Japanese, this is, it's beyond a geographic threat, etc. There's an obsession about this issue and fear of North Korea.
And no reason to believe it's different today than back then, that's for sure.
No, it's if anything, it's greater. And they look at how much progress North Korea has made, how little reaction there is in the world. And we see it on the Iranian front now, that the Indians, we gave a pass. The United States gave an exemption, and China, we gave an exemption. China is sending their own tankers now to pick up oil in Iran. North Korea, India set up a 20 billion rupee fund to ensure refiners in India who use Iranian oil, because the international insurers don't do it anymore. And Israel has to look at this and say, this is outrageous. I mean, we're imposing sanctions at the same time we're giving exemptions to countries that then take advantage and turn against us. And the countries in between, countries in the UAE, Dubai accuses Iran of trying to topple the government, and then Muslim Brotherhood of involvement. Saudi Arabia accuses them of being involved in these terrorist activities. And they look at this complete scenario, and they see nothing really happening. There's no real concerted action. They're meeting in Almaty today to talk about Iran. And again, we're going to see delays in Iran saying we're not going to talk about stopping enrichment.
By the way, we're making progress. Even the New York Times already admitting like it's a dog and pony show when it comes to Iran and what they're ready to concede to.
And what happens is that the West, and including sometimes the United States, seems to feel that every time Iran pledges to another meeting, that that's progress. When in fact, what they're doing is buying time. And something.
Yeah.
How many years have we warned about this on this program and telling people that this is their stock and trade? That's what they do, is to buy time, and that's what North Korea did. You know, they said they're going to cut back. They're going to cut back. They're not going to do this. They're not going to develop. In the meantime, they moved ahead with all of these developments, and despite the splits that we read about in Iran, the one thing they all have in common is the drive for a nuclear power. And we've seen many efforts to divert international attention to the debate about whether the leader of Iran, Khamenei, issued a fatwa, a religious ruling that you can't have nuclear weapons, you can't use them, when in fact he's not even authorized to issue it. He's a Shiite clergyman, but he's not a religious authority. And you don't see it on his websites. This is only something for the West. And so we see that they continue all this obfuscation. The same thing with Turkey. You know, Turkey will play the games, as we talked about before, but at the same time, with Hamas, want to become the great defenders and move ahead because there's no price to pay ever.
Well, the PA is not doing the same thing, speaking a certain way to the West and still inciting their youth with their textbooks and teachings and all that other stuff. I mean,
absolutely, they're incited. It's incitement and it's involvement. And as we're seeing with the prisoner demonstrations, they are using every pretext against Israel. We see no diminution in the kind of language they use, and whatever commitments they make are always controlled. So whatever the president thought he might have gotten from the PA, we can see are easily reversed. So they now say it's a 2-month delay. The Iranians, after all of these years, 10 years of negotiations, not one centrifuge was stopped because of it. And in fact, we see more and more how aggressive they are, whether it's in South America, whether it's in other parts. They're more undermining efforts to undermine regimes in the area, continuing to try to arm Syria, Hezbollah, and others. So what's the disincentive to countries not to engage in this kind of irresponsible behavior? And you see the spillover effect, whether it's in Lebanon, where we see more moves towards civil war with groups being pitted against one another, in Iraq, where the effect of the Syrian war now is spilling back, and we see the sectarian divide. People saying that these rebel groups that have gone to fight in Iraq are saying that the day after they topple Assad, they're going to go after Maliki, who is linked to Iran, and all the billions we poured in there has created a regime that is allowing weapons to go to Syria that is certainly not supportive of Western objectives. The al-Nusra, which is Iraq's al-Qaeda, fighting in Syria in greater numbers all the time. let alone the problem that Syria represents.
Right, but along those lines of Iran having an interest in building up the weaponry of Syria, for instance, so explain what's going on over Yontif. Did Israel in fact send a missile into some facility in Syria?
They used tank fire.
It was tank fire
into a location from which there have been multiple incidents of firing into the Golan, and when they hit an Israeli jeep on the Israeli side of the border, Israel responded because they have to send a clear message that they can't. Again, you can't allow them to escalate this to become a pretext, as we know that some of the terrorist groups have moved, the rebel groups, which include jihadists and others, have moved to border areas. It's why the United States is training thousands of opposition soldiers to be placed along the border, the southern border of Syria with Jordan and Israel, because nobody wants to see an escalation in those places. Jordan already has a severe problem with hundreds of thousands of Syrians, and nobody knows, you know, whether they'll leave and what their real role is, and who's a good guy and who's a bad guy.
So if someone were to...
We don't know amongst any of the rebel groups today. You look at the constituency of these groups, and they're backed. Some are backed by Saudi Arabia. You got the Al-Tahrir group. You have the Al-Nusra group. You have 37,000 in this Saudi-backed Al-Tahrir group, Al-Suria. You have the Gulf backing the Salafist jihadists. And then you have the Free Syrian Army with 50,000 guys. But there's no coalescence amongst them, and they try to out-extreme one another, and then you have more and more foreign fighters coming into this, all of which will spill back, and everybody's worried what happens to the day after this. And in addition to the fact that you have Iran working with Hezbollah to train tens of thousands of guys to come in the day after Assad falls, and they play both sides of the thing to ensure that they will have a say afterwards. And the big prize, of course, right now is the huge weapons and chemical weapons and missiles that are in Assad's arsenal.
So if someone were to ask you, as I'm about to, the status of Israel and Syria. Essentially, Israel is responding to any Syrian threat. I mean, you would never say that Israel's at war with Syria right now, right? But would you just say that that they are there to respond to anything that Syria does that's out of bounds?
I'd say that there are several levels. Yes, that Israel is not looking to escalate and to have the fighting come to it. It cannot allow a situation where groups that will be turn their fire later against Israel be ensconced in these border areas. Israel has, you know, built a fence along the Syrian border and is continuing to extend it. The Israel has to monitor the chemical weapons, as is the United States. That means use of drones and other means. In fact, they just came out with a story that Israel had planted rocks on an island near Tarsus, the base that the Russians used to monitor the Russian ships unloading and loading weapons, because Russia continues to supply the Syrian government, as does Iran and others. And of course, we saw the news this week that the shul, the 2,000-year-old Jobra shul, which is supposedly built over a cave where Eliyahu HaNavi crowned Elisha, where he hid, was looted and burnt. It had been attacked, hit by fire a couple of weeks ago, but now supposedly was burnt and looted, and everybody accuses the other side. So the answer is that Israel has a lot of interests in terms of what happens with Hezbollah, what happens with the Syrians directly, what happens between all of these terrorist groups, and remembering we're not going to have tens and tens of thousands of people who the day after are either going to turn on each other, and you're going to have likely a situation of total chaos, because Syria was never a real country, and it will break down into fiefdoms and fighting for turf and for control. That the if you'll notice, the new head of the Free Syrian Army, Nahum, I don't know if you saw it, there's a guy named Houthi of the National Syrian National Council.
Yeah.
He came from Texas. He's an American. He's a leader of the American Muslim Brotherhood. And nobody seems to care at all that we have this kind of group operating in the United States. And this guy then gets lionized and becomes the so-called president, even though the Free Syrian Army doesn't recognize him, and then the Arab League invited a delegation, and that caused a split. And everybody, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, all of these other countries are involved in funding groups because they all want to have a say in later on, including Turkey.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
That is only the tip of it. I mean, there's so many complications. There's so many things to talk about on each of these things. That it's so complex, and people approach it, especially the media in America, approaches this with such simplicity. You know, that they shot, they returned fire without thinking about
even when they do the North Korea story, their ignorance shines right through.
Right through, and the idea that they don't link what is happening in North Korea directly to what is happening in North Korea. You know, you also see it in Egypt where they talk about the economy. They don't talk about, you know, what the real implications of what's happening in Egypt. For instance, Egypt now is filling their military academy, which trains the officers, with jihadists, with guys from the Muslim Brotherhood. So the military, which was the pro-Western element now, is being poisoned as well with the presence and that the future leadership of the army is going to be all Muslim Brotherhood guys. And you see the restrictions, the attempts to reform the Interior Ministry, which controls the police, and putting Muslim Brotherhood guys in control of all this. In the meantime, the economy is in free fall. The people, there are demonstrations against the regime, and you hardly read about it in Port Said and other places. There was elections in student elections in various campuses across Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood was defeated. The journalists syndicate elected an opponent of the Muslim Brotherhood, so did others. So amongst the elites inside, you see these expressions of opposition, but they get no support from the outside. There's a thing called the Battle of the Mountain in the heart of Cairo, which is right next to where the Muslim Brotherhood headquarters are. There are pitched battles, violent battles going on, and food is soaring. Cooking oil went up 60% in the last 2 weeks. This is a situation that is going to continue to escalate out of control, and it will feed more and more the opportunities for extremists.
Unbelievable. Malcolm, have a wonderful Shabbos, and we will speak again next week.
Well, everybody should have a good Shabbos, and they shouldn't see all of this. A lot of this presents opportunities, and I think the recognition increasing that Israel is not the problem in the Middle East, and it's not the Palestinian-Israeli issue. You see that, if anything, Israel is the source of stability, and that's how more and more leaders in the region are looking at it. So there are opportunities. We didn't talk about the president's visit and what it really meant in the longer term. If you look at the polls, it didn't have a radical impact on the people, at least not in the immediate polls. But the level of involvement we will have to see in the part of the United States in the coming weeks as well.
I got to disagree with you based on what I read about the Israeli polls regarding the president's visit, but we'll talk about that next week. Have a good Shabbos and thank you.
Good Shabbos.
Malcolm Hohnlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Our weekly update, 7:40 Eastern Time, Friday mornings, right here at JM in the AM.